Hello and welcome back to Podcasts from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. The new government of national unity is off to have its first Lekgotla, or for those of you who don't live in South Africa, discussion group this week. And we must all hope that it remains true to its aim of ensuring that the election manifestos of all the parties involved are in some degree reflected in its outcome. And of course, that the outcome isn't folded up and packed away afterwards so that businesses can continue as usual. Preparing to write my column for the Sunday Times late last week, I found myself going down a rabbit hole I'm thoroughly enjoying and that I hope the Lekgotla can spend more than a cursory minute on in order for it to rate a mention in its published conclusion. It's the future and what it's going to be like, particularly with regard to energy and artificial intelligence. And the more I read, the more obvious it became, or it becomes, that whatever arguments, some petty and some perhaps substantial, whatever arguments we may have about energy now, we'll all end up inevitably in the same place. It may be important to some people that the Chinese build a new coal-fired power station every 2 weeks or whatever the latest outrageous Chinese numbers are, or that the Europeans, in the wake of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, are investing heavily in natural gas, or at least in new facilities to import it. But the arc of progress in technology is as clear as it will ever be. The world is moving towards clean and renewable energy. Consumers want it that way, and the customer is king. Scientists are sure now that if we could capture just 0.01% of the energy that reaches us from the sun, we could more than supply all of the power the Earth needs. I read a wonderful essay in The Economist last week, and it cheered me up enormously. Quote, "This year the world will make something like 70 billion solar cells," it read, "the vast majority of them in China, and sandwich them between sheets of glass to make what the industry calls modules, or other people call panels, 60 to 72 cells at a time, typically, for most of the modules which end up on residential roofs, more for those destined for commercial plant. Those panels will provide power to family homes, to local electricity collectors, to specific industrial installations, and to large electric grids. They'll sit unnoticed on roofs, charmingly outside rural schools, controversially across pristine deserts, prosaically on the balconies of blocks of flats, and in almost every other setting imaginable. Once in place, they'll sit there for decades, making no noise, emitting no fumes, using no resources, costing almost nothing, and generating power. It's the least obtrusive revolution imaginable." So we're getting to the point where our children might at least enjoy such abundant power that it becomes free. And that's without using our other main source for future fuel power, which is water and hence hydrogen. And that's to say nothing, again, about artificial intelligence, which will, in just a few years, know more than all knowledge in humanity and be able to calculate its complexities and solutions faster than we can imagine. My guest then today is someone for whom all of this is probably old hat, if not a little dull. Neil Jacobson is a futurist. A South African, he's co-founder of Future World and an advisor to governments and companies all around the world. In the past few weeks, he's been talking to the Indian government's top 100 civil servants in the Himalayas. At Oxford University, he's taught government leaders from Qatar, Dubai, Oman, and Abu Dhabi, amongst others. He's a fount of knowledge about what our new world is going to look like. So, Neil, thank you and welcome. Thank you for joining me. South Africa's brand new government is meeting in conclave this week. You know us well. What would be the single most pressing thing you'd want to tell them if you were there? Is there anything more fundamental? Is there any more fundamental revolution rushing at us than the ones in energy and knowledge?
Oh, Peter, that's a wonderful way to start this podcast because energy is indeed such a critical factor. Do you know that the International Energy Commission published its 2023 report recently? And they said this is the tipping point. For the first time ever last year, the world produced or spent more money on solar than they did on oil production. For every dollar spent on oil production, there was $1.70 spent on solar. And as you say, there's hydrogen, there's hydropower, and so forth. And one of the big concerns that I'm sure our new government is going to be thinking about, particularly with the trade unions and the communists as part of it, is, well, what about the jobs? We have to protect jobs. Well, there's a fascinating society called visualcapitalist.com. And they did a study, how many jobs would be lost in the energy revolution if we moved to renewable energy compared to how many new jobs would be created. And their figures were 3 million jobs lost, but 13.3 million new jobs created by 2030. And surely, apart from energy, employment, these have to be the concerns of this new government.
We're used now to hearing magical, not magical, exciting figures like the ones you've just presented. Are they real? I mean, are the people doing them? You know, are they speaking their own book or talking to their own book, or are these projections testable and credible and valid, I suppose?
Oh, they absolutely are, Peter. I mean, the IEC, the International Energy Commission, is not a lobby for one particular form of energy. It simply measures energy usage and energy growth around the world. So their figures are highly regarded and highly trustworthy. But yeah, there's just no question. But, you know, energy is just one factor. For me, the big issue, as that Lakhotla gets underway, I wonder whether there's any thought as to the fact that the world is changing at a space and at a pace and a speed that we've never ever seen in history before. I call it exponential growth, exponentiality. That, you know, it's not that straight line growth that we're used to. It's this exponential curve that we're going at, which means that we're going to see more change in the next 20 years than we have in the last 100 years. And I suspect and I fear that many of the members sitting in that Lakhotla are not even going to be thinking about that. They're still thinking in a linear fashion. And boy, oh boy, I mean, has it slapped the ANC in the head that the voters are not thinking in a linear fashion? They are changing very, very dramatically. And that, to my mind, has to be one of the first thoughts. What is the dream for what we want our country to look like in 10 and 15 years' time? What legacy do we want to give to our children? I understand that during the original talks when we created the Constitution of South Africa, when the ANC, or rather the National Party and the ANC, sat down together, that was one of the breakthrough points where the discussion was, let's not talk about what's happened in the past, let's focus on what we want for our children in the future. And what a wonderful dream that would be if they were to start off that Lakhotla by saying, let's put all of our differences aside. Let's not squabble over petty power and who gets what seat and so forth. Let's imagine what our country could look like in 10 and 15 years' time. And if they were to start with that kind of a mindset, can you imagine what the outcome could possibly be? Because we all want the same thing. We want economic growth. We want great schools for our kids. We want a secure energy supply. All of these things are possible if we just put the past behind us and turn around, stop running our country by looking in the rearview mirror, turn around and look to the future, create a dream of what that future could look like, and then say, how do we get there?
So, you know, one of the things that's lacking at a Lakhotla like this is a sort of future champion, I suppose. I mean, somebody who could start that discussion without being laughed at. You know, if John Steenhuisen were to say what you've just said, they'd say, well, yeah, you know, you're trying to sort of walk away from apartheid or whatever, you know, whatever they could throw at him. What's required of a person sitting in there to grab their attention, you know, fundamental, non-partisan, non-political way? What would grab them so that they sort of, you know, sit up in their recliners and listen to them? I mean, there's nobody I can think of in the room now who would do it. But just if we were to imagine, you know, what would be the 1 minute message that somebody could start off that would make them sit up and really listen to them?
Well, to my mind, it would be that the fact that the people have spoken, you know, the outcome of the elections was staggering, shocked the country. And what frightens me the most, Peter, is that in particular, the ANC doesn't seem to realize that they are no longer in power. They're clinging to that linear line of doing what they've always done before. One need only look at what's happening in Gauteng in particular to see that, you know, that's just horrifying. And when I hear like Fikile Mbalula talking about the DA as, you know, our class enemy, for God's sake, those are outdated, idealistic nonsense. We have to move beyond that. How do you do that? How do you get them motivated? Somehow, we've got to get the message across to them that the world is not what it used to be, and that in the next 10 or 15 years, it is going to be even more radically different.
Politicians generally would think that you know, everything's under control and they think they can control the pace of change. I'm just trying to think what physical manifestations of new technology, new ideas, new knowledge would look like. I mean, what would our society, you know, if you were to land here, having been away for, I don't know, a year, what would a a society that had thrown itself full into new technology look like?
Peter, I've just done a fascinating case study on what the Greek government has done in 18 months. They decided they were going to become a digitally driven society. Now, admittedly, they've got, what, 11 million people, which is a bit less than us. But what they did in 18 months, they said, how do we actually bring every citizen on board? And what fascinated me, they didn't start from the perspective of saying, how do we protect the bureaucracy? They said, let's look at the future through the eyes of our citizens. And they said, let's measure every single touch point that a citizen has from birth to death. And they've created 5,500 touch points in a digital core on which the country is based, using artificial intelligence and all the other techniques, where they can measure every single touch point for a citizen throughout their entire life. And that's completely changed the way that they're looking at it. You're now looking at the possibility that every citizen in South Africa could, in five years' time, forget it, in 2 years' time, be carrying on their cell phones a mechanism, a bot that measures every interaction they have with government. Now, imagine if not only our municipalities and our provincial governments, but if national government got feedback every single time a citizen touched a government service. In Greece now, if you change your address, you enter it once into that database, it ripples across all the services. You never have to stand in a queue. Everything is done digitally. That is possible in our South Africa. Every one of our citizens carries a cell phone. I'll never forget back in the business day days when I interviewed the head of Telkom, when cell phones came out, he said there's a market for 1 million cell phones in South Africa. What do we have now? 200 million active SIM contracts? The cell phone has become the tool of the future, and it is going to become the tool by which citizens measure how their government serves them. And if that isn't going to be a wake-up for government, I can't imagine what is.
You'd think the cell phone story would alert politicians to the rates of change and the, you know, the speed, particularly with artificial intelligence. They reckon that AI will know more than all of collective humanity in about 6 years' time, if that's not too far away. And not only that, but we'll be able to calculate or recalculate all of the sort of complexities and possibilities in, you know, very quickly, in minutes and seconds, if possible. Let's just go through the future then. One for the state. You've spoken about Greece. What about companies? I mean, companies surely, new energy, new AI, new knowledge, what happens to companies? I mean, presumably the future for them, if they are open to it, is just breathtaking.
I don't know if you've ever come across a guy called Peter Diamandis, who founded the Singularity University, one of the great sort of futurists of the world, who's written a number of books. I came across a very powerful quote from him the other day, talking about companies and AI. And he said, by 2030, there will be two kinds of companies: those that are fully immersed into artificial intelligence and those that are out of business. Something changed about 2 years ago when ChatGPT broke on the world. You know, before that, AI was something that the big tech companies were involved in. It was Google and it was Microsoft and so forth. Suddenly with ChatGPT, everybody had access to AI. You and I can use AI. I use AI constantly in my presentations to generate images that don't exist. I can create video that doesn't exist by simply typing in commands, et cetera, et cetera. So AI has become a common commodity for absolutely everybody. And quite frankly, if you're in business and if you're not employing AI, if you're not looking at how you can either use generative AI or proper AI to make your processes, to make your interface with customers, to make your manufacturing much, much more efficient, then you are going to go out of business, because there are competitors out there who are simply going to do what you do faster, quicker, and infinitely cheaper. That concept of exponential, 10 times the speed and 10 times the efficiency at 1/10 of the cost. And you know, our local hero, Elon Musk, has shown us that going to space. It used to cost $430 million for a space launch. He's doing it for $44 million now, 1/10 of the cost. Just one example, an engineering example. This is not a Facebook or something that's just working on digital code. This is building rockets and sending them up to space. It's possible, and it's happening.
One of the preoccupations of the South African government in particular is black empowerment, redress of some kind, in some kind of a way. And I was trying to think of ways in which AI would make that easier or cheaper, or, you know, just blow barriers away completely. I mean, it should, if people know how to use it, because obviously it's one thing to have the technology. It's another thing to know how best to use it. But all of the debates we're having at the moment about competition and, you know, big established so-called white businesses keeping small up-and-coming black businesses out of key markets. With AI, that just becomes, I mean, it blows all of that away. There's no need, in a way, for a long and torturous political process to go ahead if the people wanting to get into sectors A, B, or C are simply able to contrive strategies with the help of artificial intelligence, but which by definition should know not only everything about their competitors, but also come up with good ideas about how to beat them.
Well, let me again refer back to India, where, as you say, I've just come back from the Himalayas. India grew at 8% in the first quarter, GDP first quarter this year. Can you imagine what South Africa would do if it was growing at 8%? And what have they done? Huge program called Digital India, a huge program called Made in India. They created years ago something called Aadhaar, the digital identity. There are now more than 1 billion people in this chaotic democracy called India who have a digital identity, which enables them to interface with governments digitally through their cell phones without having to stand in home affairs queues, without having to phone call centers that never get answered and so forth. Now, just think of what that could do. If government was to say, we're going to set out a program to digitize every South African, to provide them with the digital identity, and then to link that to government services. So if I'm sitting in rural KwaZulu-Natal and I need something, I can actually use my cell phone to reach government services, or I can involve myself in business through those kind of processes. And if we can strip away the bureaucracy of starting a new business, of finding suppliers or whatever, but that requires government, and that requires this Lakota, and please God, some of those new ministers on board, to say, guys, we cannot do things the way we've done them in the past. We have to embrace a totally different future that is going to be driven by technology and particularly driven by artificial intelligence.
To what extent is that future already here? I mean, to what extent is it doable now?
Well, I mean, there are plenty of examples around the world of governments that are just doing that. India, again, has launched a program to take the whole process of a business interfacing with the tax authorities and saying, how do we remove all the friction from that process? How do we make it a seamless, simple process? Now, you know, identify every pain point in the relationship between business and government and ask yourself, how do we remove those pain points? How do we use technology to remove those pain points? But keep a human element, because there's always going to be people who want to talk to another human being because they're frightened of technology. They're like me, they're older generation, or whatever it might be. And again, Greece did it so well, where they built the digital database, but they kept the people in place to help, to take people by the hand and lead them to that digital, yeah, digital marketplace.
Talk to us a little bit about health and education. Health is particularly interesting because it promises so much in terms of what particularly AI can do. You know, once it knows your genetic sequence, which would normally presumably take, you know, an AI-enabled instrument a couple of seconds to figure out, it presumably can change your life or save your life or lengthen it.
It's interesting that one of the biggest players in health worldwide now is Amazon. They've created Amazon Health. In fact, a colleague of mine that I've worked with in the past has now been made head of Amazon Health. And their specific goal is to say, how can we again take the friction out of health? How can we give you access to health without you having to go and book an appointment, unless you really need it, to sit in the doctor's room or to sit in the waiting room? And you know what the state hospitals are like in this country, how long it takes you to actually get assistance, sure, and so forth. So much of that could be digitized. So much of that could be made available to rural people where through a cell phone or through some kind of a simple clinic visit, you could access health facilities. It's not rocket science, Peter, and it's not something we have to invent. It is being done all over the world. And if our health department was to turn around to an organization like Amazon and say, can we form a partnership with you? Can you help us to do this? I'm quite sure these things could be done quickly within a couple of years. You know, it's very interesting. There's something I've followed for many generations called the Edelman Trust Barometer.
Yeah.
And they measure 38 countries around the world. They measure trust in government, trust in the media, trust in companies, and trust in NGOs. And their 24 reporters just come up, and really powerful comments for government. Number one, they say that business is the most trusted institution in the world because of ethics and competence. Number two, they say there is huge doubt whether government has the ability to keep abreast of the technological changes that are happening. Therefore, there's a massive surge in demand for government-business partnerships. And again, what to say to that Lakota that's happening right now? Business is not the enemy. You have to put that old socialist communist ideology behind you. Business is your partner for going forward. Reach out to business, say, how do we work together to build the society that we'd all like to see for our children? That I mean, you ask, what one message would I give them? Perhaps that's the strongest message of all.
South African business itself is slow to move on these things, isn't it? I mean, we live in our business culture is old, not quite Victorian, but it's been around for a very long time. So governments, I can understand governments needing to, you know, to pull their thumb out because they need to get reelected. What's the driving force for companies? Is it just competition, or is it more complicated than that?
I think it's more complicated than that. I think competition is going to be the big driving factor. As I say, companies that are not using AI are going to find themselves simply outclassed in the marketplace. But the big driving factor as well, I think, is going to be a new generation. I'm very, very optimistic about the youth, not only in our country, but around the world. I think they are very different from my generation and your generation. I think that they see the world differently. They are technically literate. And I think young people coming into business in South Africa and moving up the ranks are not going to be content with the old ways. Legacy causes friction. My legacy is a wonderful thing if it's the values of the company and so forth. But, you know, old ways slow things down. And I think young people are going to be the spark that is actually going to overturn a lot of those things.
Yeah.
And if South African companies don't, they will simply be left behind.
And education really interested me. And I was imagining, because I know some of the rural schools in Transkei, where I come from in the Eastern Cape, and they really have nothing. I mean, these are schools without windows, sometimes without floors. You know, it's really, really poor infrastructure. But technically, even today, you could put a teacher up on a screen who could not only speak to them in isiXhosa, but would know their names, where they sit, what they need to do.
Yeah.
Whether they've done their homework, whether they need to improve on X or Y. I mean, the opportunity, particularly in education, is just staggering.
Well, I was so encouraged to hear our new education minister say that the first thing she's going to do is undertake a review of the syllabus, because I think our syllabus is 25 years out of date.
Yeah.
We're not teaching children how to perform in a world that's very, very different from the school days that they're living in now. So, I mean, that's point one. Get that syllabus updated. And, of course, it was, again, sad to see the ANC presidential spokesman saying, oh, the ministers can't do things without cabinet approval. Well, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy, how many times have the ANC ministers gone ahead without cabinet approval to do what they want to do? So, number one, get that syllabus sorted. But number two, you're absolutely right. The Khan Institute, for example, there are many, many examples. The best education in the world is available to all of us through the internet. Now, it needs a powerful, dedicated leader who says we're going to change the nature of education in this country. We're going to put the best teachers in the world in front of every single child. And it's possible, can be done. And again, business, if you have the right leadership in place and the right management of that process, business would flock to help in terms of providing terminals, in terms of providing access and so forth. Education is one of the real factors for the growth of our economy. And, you know, how do we bring the black, previously disadvantaged people into society? Economic growth is the only way we can do it. And how do you get economic growth? Economic growth through great education. You get economic growth through waking businesses and government up to how the world is changing and how we have to think differently about the future.
So you know, one of the problems, particularly in education, with you know, let's say you were able to get to the point where a school in Mkanduli or Elliot Dale in Transkei was able to provide literally the best teachers in the world to speak to young children in their own indigenous language, and know everything about them. Obviously, the first people threatened by that are the unions, the teachers who teach now, who are sometimes brilliant under very difficult circumstances and sometimes absolutely hopeless. You did talk about earlier on about, you know, what sort of jobs these in a new world would cost and how many it would create. But let's just talk about that a little bit more. I mean, how do you, what is the new tech or the new revolution or the AI promise to a, you know, a rural teacher in South Africa? She or he may no longer be necessary.
I think it's not an instantaneous shift over, Peter. You're going to need people on the ground still. You're going to need teachers. And, you know, you're going to need for them to become re-educated as well. I do think that the so-called South African Democratic Teachers Union, which is a joke of a name as far as I'm concerned, is a huge roadblock in terms of advancing education in this country, because they, again, are trying to cling to the past. So that's something that we have to break, is the stranglehold that the unions have on particular sectors. But how do you evolve a rural teacher then in a different kind of an education system? You've got to retrain that teacher. They're not necessarily going to be the teacher. They're going to be the facilitator in the classroom. They're going to be assisting the students. They're going to be playing a different kind of a role. But, you know, in every time there's been a major change in our society, we look back to the Industrial Revolution and the Luddites who went around smashing machines with hammers because they were taking jobs away. Every time there's been a revolution of some kind, initially there's a drop-off in jobs, but in the long run, there's a tremendous spurt in terms of the creation of new jobs. So yes, there's going to be short-term pain for people, but you cannot stop progress. You cannot stop this revolution that you refer to in the intro by saying we're going to hold it back because of people in trade unions, mine workers, because of, you know, rural teachers and so forth. You have to come up with methodologies of how you're going to retrain and reposition those people in an economy that is now forward-facing rather than backward-facing.
And the same would apply to, you know, sort of lazy and tired managers in big companies, presumably used to doing the things the way they've always done them, the way they've always been done before. So I spoke earlier about at the Lekgotla, if there were a champion for AI and a champion for the new world sort of rushing towards us. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm sure Bladen Zamande was once again the Minister of Science and Technology, and he doesn't really have a history of looking forward in his policy making. I wonder, is there a structure or institution that Cyril Ramaphosa could create that he might find useful in this transition to accept it? You know, is it in government? Is there a minister of the future? Or how do we help him come to grips with what's going to happen to him, whether he likes it or not?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look at one of the great booming economies of the world, Dubai, and you know, they're busy working on their 2073 vision. They created a minister of the future who does nothing but look at opportunities and then create infrastructure for those opportunities to happen. 3D printing, for example, they're 3D printing buildings already and so forth. So yeah, I mean, if only we could persuade Cyril to actually say, you know, let's find the right person, create a minister of the future, create a portfolio that says these are the big opportunities for us. And it's, you know, it's not, as you've written in your column so many times, it's not to try to beneficiate the raw materials we produce and so forth. There's simply other people who can do that more effectively. But there's so much on the digital front that we could do. And if we can kickstart our economy, then we start to address the issue of job creation. We start to address the issue of the previously disadvantaged. We overcome the health and education challenges and so forth. So come on, Peter, write a column for Cyril to say, create a ministry of the future and have a look at what's been done in Dubai. Have a look at what Greece did. They created a digital...
I don't think he listens to me anymore. But the government, all governments, I'm sure, not just this one, will try and control and regulate artificial intelligence in some way. Can it be done?
This is one of the big, big concerns of the world, of course. Are we creating a monster that's going to ultimately take us over? You know, the vision of the Hollywood robot, eliminate, eliminate, eliminate. Or are we, in fact, creating something that's going to free us to be much more effective as human beings? None of us know the answer to that yet. That's one of the big debated questions right across science and philosophy right now. Can you regulate it? You can hopefully ensure that the code that is written is based on an ethical foundation, a moral foundation. What frightens me is that the code that's being written for AI is being written by 24-year-old kids around the world, be they in America, be they in China.
But these are the ones that you've got all the faith in, Neil.
Some of them. I don't think there's a lot of ethics in terms of the way they see things. So I think it's the role of government is to say, we have to make sure that AI is applied ethically for the good of mankind. Having said that, I've just read an article about how the United States is now working on AI-controlled soldiers.
Yep.
Who will be out in the field and so forth. No, those kind of concepts are terrifying. But Peter, the bottom line is it's unstoppable. It is absolutely unstoppable. We are going to progress towards it. We may well end up damaging humanity. We may well end up freeing humanity. I don't know the answer to that yet. But what I do know is that we cannot stop the progress of technology and in particular artificial intelligence. I mean, behind that comes quantum computing and all sorts of other things. We cannot stop it. So all we can do is try to make sure that it is applied in such a way that it ultimately is for the benefit of humanity and not to the detriment of our species.
Take the next 5 or 10 years. My final question. I mean, so what do we know for certain? What can we predict for absolute certain? 100% it's going to happen. Not happened yet, but it will happen. And how do we prepare for it?
Okay, well, number one, we can certainly predict that artificial intelligence is going to take away probably 30 to 40% of the jobs that we know of in the marketplace right now, across companies, across business, across society. So we have to, find ways to create new jobs. We know for certain that there are going to be new jobs that we haven't even thought about yet. Many of the things our youngsters are learning at university are going to be irrelevant by the time they walk out of those universities. We know that transport is going to change. We know that energy is changing. You started off by saying, it's the greatest revolution of all. We know that energy, potentially not within 5 years, but certainly within 10 to 15 years, could become free and abundant. We know that under wise governments, education, health, all of government services could become available to anybody, and that the pain points, the friction of getting those services, the queues and so forth, can be removed. Now, that will happen in a number of societies around the world. Whether or not these things happen in our own society is very much going to happen, depend on whether that lahotia descends into power struggles and fights between, quote, the class enemy and the ANC, or whether they actually buckle down and say the electorate has given us a mandate to make this a better country. One of the most powerful quotes I've ever heard that has driven me for a long time, a man called Stephen Elop was running Nokia, and you know what happened to Nokia. They made the best handsets in the world, they missed the smartphone revolution, and they crashed. And when they were bought out by Microsoft, these are the words he said: "We didn't do anything wrong, but somehow we lost."
Yeah.
Now, if the new government doesn't actually change, they're going to turn around in 3 or 4 years' time and say, "We didn't do anything wrong, but somehow we lost." And that's the threat and the challenge that lies ahead for them and for us as a country.
Oh, well, heaven help us all. Thank you, Neil. And listen, that was fabulous. How can government or government departments or companies or schools or universities who want to know more about what's coming our way find you? Are you even available in this country anymore?
Yes, I am. I'm sitting in Johannesburg right now. I'm easily accessible. Simply Neil, N-E-I-L, at futureworld.org, Neil at futureworld.org, or go to the Future World website, futureworld.org, and you can find all sorts of things. There's a whole section on scenarios of the future and so forth. We write a mind bullet every week, which is a scenario of what might happen. All of these things are available. So either come to Neil at futureworld.org or go to the website futureworld.org.
Well, I hope Bladen Zamanda, for one, is listening or does listen, or somebody slips him a note during the lahotia. But Neil, thanks again, and thank you all for joining me this week. I'll be back next week for another edition of Podcasts on the Edge. And in the meantime, be safe and be careful. Bye for now.